This is the first day of this December 2007 four-day session. And we'll start with an anthology of writings called The Original Face. That's the name of the book. And it's an anthology of Rinzai Zen teachings. Rinzai is the Japanized version of the Chinese master Linchi. There are two schools now left in Japan, and one of them is the Rinzai school, and the other is the Soto. Before I begin reading from this text, just a few words about practice during Taisho. First of all, if you need the Hakuin chant sheet that was just offered to people, passed out to people, want it, you just keep it now. Slip it under the corner of your mat, whatever corner makes sense to you, and can use it for the rest of Sesshin. Listening to Taisho is another practice opportunity, like everything else. If your practice is breath practice while you're sitting, then you just let that go while you're listening to Taisho and just purely listen, simply listen. Listening itself is, in general, is a marvelous practice, rather hearing, just hearing. What makes it so difficult is that rather than simply listening, our tendency from lifetimes of misusing our minds, our tendency is to get stuck on something that's being said, to weave thoughts about what was just said, to relate it to oneself, to have thoughts about oneself in relation to what was said, to have associations about what was just said. And while we're doing all of that extraneous associative material, we're missing what's being said because we're caught in a particular sentence or point of the Taisho. Instead, to just be open, just let in whatever is being said moment by moment without clinging to anything and without going off in any tangent in one's own mind. It's a demanding practice. So, whenever, if your practice is breath practice or shikantaza in the zendo, then when listening to Taisho or when doing anything outside the zendo, you don't try to keep the breath going. You just are one with whatever you're doing, whether it's listening to Taisho or drinking tea or vacuuming a carpet. If your practice is a koan, then the best thing is to, yes, listen to Taisho, but with the awareness of the koan in the back of your mind. This isn't as difficult as it may seem at first. Most people, I think, take a little getting used to that, but after a while, you can have sort of a rear awareness of the koan. It's sort of there in the mind, and yet you're still hearing what is being said in Taisho. If it seems those two things seem to be in conflict, then the better thing is just to drop the koan and simply listen to the Taisho. During Taisho, we relax the no-moving rules a little, and people are free to change posture once or twice. It shouldn't be necessary to change it more than twice in a 45-minute Taisho. That's not very long between posture changes. And when you do change your posture, just please do so as quietly and unobtrusively as you can, so you don't distract other people too much. After Taisho, when Taisho ends, the best thing, the thing what I would want most, is for you to completely forget about Taisho. Forget it. When Taisho is over, 5 minutes later, 10 minutes later, an hour later, where is Taisho? There's no Taisho. It's just a memory. It's just the reverberation of words in the mind that you don't want to hold on to. Things may come up, yes. Things may bubble up that were said in Taisho, but you want to just return your attention to your practice. This text is a nice little collection of teachings by different Rinzai masters, some of them Chinese and some of them Japanese. The first one is called Daikaku's Treatise on Sitting Meditation. And he's a Chinese master, so let's use his Chinese name. Lanshi Daolong. And he was a contemporary of the great Japanese master Dogen. It's a good basic instructions or teaching on meditation, Zazen as a whole. Here's how it begins. Sitting meditation is the method of great liberation. All the teachings flow forth from this. Myriad practices are mastered this way. Supernormal powers, knowledge, wisdom, and virtue all arise from here. The path of life of humans and gods opens herein. All the Buddhas have entered and left by this door. Bodhisattvas practicing it have entered this door. Let's just pause here. Whenever you hear Buddhas, plural, it refers to the enlightened ones. Buddha, remember, Buddha means enlightenment or awakening. In the Hakuin chant, when we say, excuse me, in the Kanongyo, when we begin by saying, Kanzeon, praise to Buddha. We're not praising Shakyamuni so much. Yeah, that's sure, why not praise him? But more to the essential point of it is we're praising this mind, this essential mind that we all are endowed with in equal measure, this Buddha mind. Bodhisattvas, you could see, if broadly speaking, are the rest of us working toward full enlightenment. Bodhisattva is anyone who is sincerely working for the sake of others, basically. And when you're doing real true Zazen, you're working for the sake of others. This is not a private thing. You're purifying mind. Mind does not stop in one's skull. It's not limited to what's inside one's brain. Mind is, as Dogen said, mind is the mountains and rivers and grasses and stones. For people who have any guilt about leaving family, to come to Sesshin, think of it this way, that it is going to, Sesshin, if you work hard, Sesshin will make you a better parent, a better spouse, a better child, a better grandparent, a better worker, more effective in helping others, serving others. Ultimately, this practice is not for ourselves, just ourselves. It's to be able to give more fully to others. We can't give if we are saddled with a mind of self-concern and self-centeredness. Sesshin is an intensification of Zazen and a way to purify the mind and lighten ourselves of this obsession with self, the I, the me, and the my. And this will clearly benefit other people. If you want to be a better mother, do Zazen intensively. If you want to be a better father, do Zazen intensively. Better teacher, better neighbor, better nurse, better physician. All the Buddhas have entered and left by this door. Bodhisattvas practicing it have entered this door. Whatever esoteric or exoteric schools do not practice this, do not have anyone who realizes the way of Buddhahood. It's a pretty strong statement, I don't know. But earlier here, where we read, all the teachings flow forth from Zazen. Myriad practices, all the different practices are mastered through Zazen. We just recited that in the Hakuin chant. Upholding the precepts. There's a whole school of Buddhism that emphasizes upholding the precepts, mastering the precepts. Upholding the precepts, repentance. In some schools of Buddhism, that's more stronger than it is in Zen. Upholding the precepts, repentance, and giving. Giving is the first of the six perfections of practice. The countless good deeds and the way of right living all come from Zazen. I think this is what is one of the strongest appeals of Zen to many of us, is that it goes to the root of what are more broadly thought of as religious practices, doing good, helping others, virtue, service, self-mastery, purification, compassion. It all comes down to emptying the mind so that our natural virtue and compassion and wisdom can come forth, can be actualized. Stripping away the habit forces, the mental obstructions and other habit forces that prevent this, our natural compassion from flowing. Freeing the mind of the bondage of thoughts. And then we go to a question and answer format here in this old text. Oh, I forgot to read about Daikaku. We have a little information about Daikaku, not very much. Or his Chinese name, Lang Shi. He was born and began practice in Western China. After learning the sutras, studying the sutras in various places, he took up the practice of Chan or Zen and trained under several Chan masters, finally attained enlightenment. He heard that Zen was not well known in Japan, despite the fact that other teachings, other Buddhist teachings, were flourishing there. So he crossed the sea to Japan with several of his disciples when he was just 33 years old. And then he spent the next 33 years teaching there in Japan. That's also roughly, that's the same century that Zen Master Dogen was crossing the sea of Japan. First, as a Japanese, he went back to China to get the original teachings, and then I went back to Japan, of course. Question: what does it mean that Zazen is the root source of all the teachings? And then Langchi says, Zazen is the inner mind of the enlightened ones. Discipline is their outer character. Doctrine is their speech. Buddha remembrance is the invocation of Buddha's name. All come from the enlightened mind of the Buddhas. Therefore, it is considered fundamental. Zazen is the inner mind of the enlightened one. So when we are doing Zazen, real egoless Zazen, Zazen without the I, the me, and the my, pure Zazen, then we are dwelling in the mind of enlightenment. It's not something we have to go to, certainly nothing outside ourselves. We just have to allow this mind to reach us, to access us. And that happens through the various sitting practices, breath and koan and shikantaza. Our nature is enlightenment. So Zazen is the inner mind of the enlightened ones. Discipline is their outer character. Discipline is another word for morality or ethics, which we just focused on in the Jukai ceremony a couple weekends ago, last weekend. Discipline is their outer character. Doctrine is their speech. So the sutras, we could say, is the words of... they're purportedly of the Buddha. The sutras are supposed to be of the Buddha, except for a couple that are recognized as... one is the Platform Sutra. It's the teaching of the sixth patriarch, Wei Nung. Is the Vimalakirti Sutra. But most of the sutras, the vast majority of sutras, are attributed to Shakyamuni Buddha. But scholars will point out that some of those sutras were actually written after the time of the Buddha. So, but in any case, they are the words of enlightened ones for sure. And then this thing, Buddha remembrance is the invocation of Buddha's name. This is a practice not of Zen as we know it in the West or in Japan, but it's the practice of the Pure Land school of Buddhism. And the idea of this Buddha remembrance or Buddha's name is that you chant a formula. You try to keep this going in your mind all the time instead of a koan. You're chanting Namu Amida Butsu, Namu Amida Butsu. I place my faith in the Buddha Amida. And the idea is that if you can keep this going continuously enough, that it's another gateway to liberation. But in Japan, it's really wasn't part of Zen, and it was in China. This is a Chinese master, this Langchi. But I've never I've never seen the point of it myself. I've got zazen. But anyway, all of these things, the sitting, the zazen, the discipline, all come from the enlightened mind of the Buddhas. Therefore, it is considered fundamental. Because our fundamental nature is enlightenment. We have another nature, a nature of it's vulnerable to greed, ill will, delusion. It's not our fundamental nature. But our original, our fundamental nature is that of enlightenment, enlightened wisdom and compassion. One of my favorite statements of the Buddha, of his many profound statements, is that this mind is pure and self-luminous, but it is stained by adventitious defilements. This mind, and there's just one mind, this mind is pure and self-luminous. But that's its original nature. That's the ground we start from, is that purity and luminosity. But it's stained, it's marred by adventitious defilements. Adventitious meaning defilements that are not essential to us. They come and go. Through practice, we gradually, usually it's gradual, we gradually slough off these defilements, or at least see through them enough, that they don't have the same burden to ourselves and to others. Question. The method of meditation is formless and thoughtless. Spiritual qualities are not obvious, and there is no proof of seeing reality. So how can we believe in this? Let's just first look at this question again. Zazen, and whatever stripe of zazen we're doing, is formless and thoughtless. That is, we don't want to, in true zazen, there should be no image in the mind, no thought, no form at all to it. If we see things in the mind, if we see designs, words, concepts, then it's not true zazen. The one word that we may hold in the mind is this mu or who or what, and this one word then becomes a no word. When we really devote ourselves to it single-mindedly, then this word becomes a no word. It's designed, mu, for example, is designed to lead us beyond all forms, mind forms. But ultimately, what awakening reveals is this formless aspect of reality that is beyond thoughts as well. So he says this zazen is formless and thoughtless. Spiritual qualities are not obvious. This is true, actually. There's a wonderful saying in Zen, nothing distinguishes the enlightened person. What this means is that the highest reaches of Zen practice bring us to a state of ordinariness. We're not buzzing with some kind of aura or charisma, but there's a simplicity, an utter simplicity, and maybe a better word is a transparency to someone who's far advanced in practice. Spiritual qualities are not obvious. There's nothing special. We often say in Zen, just be ordinary. Stop trying to be special. When we say just be ordinary, is another way of saying just be yourself. That's all we're doing here. All of these exertions and sesshin, the pain, the struggle. We're just trying to get back to being ourselves most authentically. In the ultimate sense, that means becoming Buddha, realizing this self nature. That's where we are most fully, completely authentic to ourselves. But even short of that, it means, short of awakening, it still means ridding ourselves of the self-consciousness that blocks us from being simply who we are. And then the third part of this question is there is no proof of seeing reality. Yeah, there is no empirical proof. There is a way to, for a teacher to gauge, to assess whether a student has had a genuine breakthrough, an awakening, or is in some other state that might masquerade as awakening. But there is no empirical proof. And so the question is, so how can we believe in this? And then Langshi says, your own mind and the enlightened mind are one. Is that not spiritual quality? If you don't know your own mind, on whom can you call for witness and proof? Other than the identity of mind and Buddha, what proof do you seek? Question: how can the ability to cultivate the teaching of one mind compare to myriad practices cultivating myriad virtues? Just to reframe this question, you know, if you, the longer you study Buddhism, or especially if you do pilgrimages, you find that there are a vast array of practices in the various schools of Buddhism. In Vajrayana Buddhism, more commonly known as Tibetan Buddhism, there are visualization practices, prostration practices, various concentration practices, all kinds of rituals, pujas, mudras. In another school of Buddhism, there is chanting is at the center of practice, various kinds of chanting, different modes of chanting. You heard about the Pure Land School reciting the name of Amida Buddha. And there are others. And whereas in Zen, there is this wonderful simplicity to it. Just follow the breath. Count the breath. Just move. So Zen is different from most other schools in that way. And the questioner here is doing this comparison. How can the ability to cultivate the teaching of one mind, that's Zen, compare to the myriad practices cultivating myriad virtues? And then Langshi says in response, when you suddenly awaken to the pure, clear meditation of those who realize thusness, these six transcendences and myriad practices are complete within your body. Thus, the one practice of meditation includes all practices. That is, if the practice is as simple and elemental as Zazen, there are other meditations, a meditation practice of meditating on loving kindness. It's called metta meditation. I wouldn't say that metta, that specific kind of meditation, loving kindness meditation, has that kind of breadth to it. It includes all other practices, because there is still the intention of doing something with metta meditation. You're still trying to radiate loving kindness. You're trying to project loving kindness. Whereas in pure Zazen, the real fundamental thing of Zazen, there's no effort to effect a change. You're just paying rapt attention to the breath or to the practice. There is no intentionality in the mind. That's another form. That's another design in the mind, the intention to do something. Zen is more basic than that. We're not intending. If there's an intention, then that's just a little contamination of the mind, seen from a Zen perspective. I do think there's value to doing metta meditation, definitely. But in pure Zen meditation, we don't have that. It's all based on this emptying the mind through the breath or the koan. So he says, the one practice of meditation, that is the Zazen, includes all practices. Haven't you heard it said that the three realms are only one mind, that outside of mind there is nothing else? Even if you do cultivate myriad practices, if you don't know the mind, you cannot realize enlightenment. And how can there be a way to fulfill the way of the Buddha if you don't realize enlightenment? This thing about intentionality is a subtle point, and I myself didn't really get it for some years. Those early years of practice, I was still trying to get enlightened, trying to get from point A to point B. And it isn't until one relinquishes that goal seeking. That you're doing real Zazen. So until then, you just do the best you can. When you notice that your mind is trafficking in thoughts of enlightenment or thoughts of whatever, you just let go of them. Get back to the practice. And the practice leads us beyond goals, beyond intentions. Question, how should we practice this method? Even if we practice, we are not sure of attaining enlightenment and fulfilling Buddhahood. And if it is uncertain, even if we do practice, what's the benefit? This is a calculating mind. This is a mind of what's in it for me? Yeah, I'll work, but I gotta have some guarantee. Can you sign something that if I'm going to work this hard, that I'm going to get something back? That very state of mind is what gets in the way. That's what blocks us. That wanting to get something. That's the biggest obstruction. So natural. Of course we want to get something. What are we doing here? We want to change. We want to achieve something. We want to attain, realize our true nature. But that's the trick is We have to relinquish all getting, all thoughts of getting anything, gaining anything. We have to relinquish it. Not by trying to relinquish it. There we are again, trying to effect a change. Thinking, all right, I want to get something out of this. Bad. Now I got to get rid of that. Now you've got another goal, getting rid of that. As long as we are caught in wanting to get anything, gain anything, lose anything for that matter, as long as there are any thoughts about any of that, then we're caught. So how do we get beyond it then? In pure absorption in mu, in pure absorption in the breath, pure absorption of any questioning, there's no grasping to get something. Then the answer to that question, this school, Zen, is an exceedingly deep and subtle teaching. Once you have heard it, it becomes an excellent cause for enlightenment for all time. All time. An ancient said, the past master, those who hear this, even if they don't believe, have blessings greater than humans or gods. Those who practice even without attainment eventually reach Buddhahood. And then Lan Shi says, this teaching is the school of the enlightened mind. The enlightened mind itself basically has no delusion or enlightenment. This is actually the subtle art of those who realize thusness. Even if you don't become enlightened, when you sit once in meditation, you are a Buddha for that sitting. When you sit for a day in meditation, you are a Buddha for a day. When you sit in meditation all your life, you are a Buddha all your life. The same is true of the future. One who can have faith in this is someone with great potential. That last statement is important. You can't confirm what he's saying except through awakening. So until awakening, faith is required of us. And so he says, one who can have faith in this is someone with great potential. There's a saying in Zen, one minute of sitting, 1 minute of being a Buddha. In sitting, we are manifesting our Buddha nature. That is, when I say sitting, I mean sitting beyond thought. Well, actually, to be truthful, even if we're sitting even with thoughts in the mind, our Buddha nature is no less. We can be sitting and having the most nasty thoughts in the mind, the most petty, jealous, envious, hateful mind. It doesn't diminish our Buddha nature at all. It just blocks us from realizing our Buddha nature. And when he says sit, we really should understand this not too literally. When he says when you sit in all your life, you're a Buddha all your life. Meaning, really what that means is, whether you're driving to work or doing anything else at work, stirring the oatmeal, chopping vegetables, sweeping the floor, plowing, snow shoveling, whatever it is, if we're doing it with bare attention, with single-minded engagement, then that's sitting in the way that he's using it. It's bringing to the activity this mind of Zazen, this mind of stabilized awareness, centeredness. In other words, just being fully present and not caught in thoughts and fantasies. That's the being, that's the activity of a Buddha, fully present, fully aware. That's another translation of the word Buddha, is aware, or awareness. Enlightened awareness is probably the best way to define Buddha. Question, if so, I can practice too. How should I rest my mind? How should I use my mind? And then he says, the enlightened mind has no attachment to appearances. Detachment from appearances is the character of reality. Among the four modes of conduct, walking, standing, sitting, and lying down, sitting is considered to be the most stable and tranquil. This means sitting straight and contemplating the characteristics of reality. Sitting is considered to be the most stable and tranquil. That's why we sit so much. There's nothing unique that we can do while sitting that we can't do at other times. It's just the easiest way of reaching this enlightened mind of ours. Accessing it is through sitting, because of the stability that we gain through the posture, these cross-legged and other postures. In these postures that we sit in, the mind is most stable and the body is most stable, and both body and mind are most easily brought to rest. That's why we sit. It's harder when we're walking around. It's harder when we're in activity, when we're working, when we're walking here and there. Certainly a lot harder when we're in conversation. So we sit because that's the easiest, the least difficult way. As difficult as it is, it's less difficult than trying to do this practice in activity. Well, this is as good as any place to stop for the day, and we'll now recite the four vows.